The following presentation was recorded at a Faith Builders colloquy. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
What can Faith Builders do to assist Christian schools? I'd like to address this in two parts. The first being, in order to know how to assist Christian schools, we should first take a little time to consider what, in fact, is the work of Christian schools. We need to know that before we can see how we can assist them. And then the second part, looking at some ways in which we can help Christian schools. I think the word that would describe the work of parents and of schools is tied up in the word heritage. Heritage, passing on a heritage. When the call to teach goes forth, the teaching sheep sense a stirring within themselves that drives them to the work. To teach by word and example the things of life. Things which all the sheep know and practice, but they, the teaching sheep, find a special fulfillment and have no rest until they see the lambs also know and practice the same things of life. We come into this life to spend a few short years here, and in those years that we have, we need to perceive and value and receive and work with the heritage that is here for us when we arrive, and we only have a few years to then see that that is safely and properly passed on to the next generation to also work with and add to that heritage. I heard an address once focused on the fifth commandment, which impressed me in that area. Honor thy father and mother, that it may be well with you, that you may live long on the earth, that your days may be long on the earth. And it was pointed out that this commandment, the fifth one, was given to adults. It's a command to adults. And furthermore, it's a command given to a people who have already been redeemed. That is, it was given to the children of Israel after they had been already led out of Egypt and were on their way to the promised land. And as we consider that, it flies in the face of what often happens in our society today, where we're ready to throw out the window those things that have been done before, to the traditions and ways and customs and understandings and values and truths and structures that have been built up over the generations before us, and to throw those things away. That is the essence of barbarism, or to not value those things which were before. And so that command was given to an adult people, and it really makes no difference at all whether the parents, whether the father or mother is still living or not. That commandment really applies to us all equally, no matter of what our age and no matter whether our parents are living or dead. The point being that we need to perceive and value the blessing that we have been born under, that has been provided to us by God through those who have gone before. It's tied up in the idea of birthright, of heritage. In order to receive the benefit of what is in this world through God and through others, we need to first of all perceive that there is such a thing existing. We do not know what our birthright is. We do not even know what our names are until we are told. How do you know what your name is? There's no way you could ever figure that out. I don't care how much intelligence you have. Somebody had to tell you. And that's the way it is with most of what we receive. There's something there for us, and we need to perceive that it's there. And then we need to care about it. And then we're in a position to receive it and to treasure it and to work with it. Now, when we think of a heritage, we often think of property, and that may be part of a heritage, but that's only a small part. We also, along with the heritage, need to learn how to use these things that we receive and why we should have them, why we should do them. Faith passes from one generation to the next, from faith to faith. And as Jesus referred to his followers, his true followers, as children of Abraham, really, there was a faith passed on from generation to generation. We talk about the fathers of various different schools of knowledge. Of course, Abraham being the father of faith. And there are things for us to learn and to receive that have been here long before we have been. One of the biggest problems in our world today is not finding resources. It's not finding abilities. It's not finding things, but it is receiving and containing them. One of the biggest problems of God is to find people who have trucks big enough, if you will, to haul the blessings. If somebody told you right now that we have for you 1 million bushels of wheat, it's on its way right now on the train. It will be in Erie at noon tomorrow. It's yours. We want you to be there to get it. Would you have the capability of receiving that blessing? Would that be a blessing to you, or would that be a problem? Well, I wouldn't have the facility to handle that. I wouldn't know what to do with it. Now, it makes me wonder sometimes how many packages, if you will, I will see sometime in heaven with my name on and be told that these are all the things that were yours that you could have had, you were supposed to have had, they were intended for you, but we couldn't give them to you because you were not ready to receive them. You didn't have the infrastructure, you didn't have the heart, you didn't have the ability, you didn't have the whatever. You just were not in a position to receive them. In our paper last week, I saw an article of a lady who suddenly found out that she was receiving $26,000. This was some property that had belonged to some relative, and they couldn't find the proper people to give it to, so it went to the state. And furthermore, the article said that the state has many items of property, some of very little value, some of great value, and they have people employed full-time trying to track down people who are entitled to these, if you will, blessings. And sometimes they find someone and they inform that person that we have something that is rightfully yours. And oftentimes this is in the form of money, and most people are wired in such a way that when they find out that there's money available, they are pleased. And so they usually take it. But the problem is that that's the case that it is with us and with children as they grow up, that there is something here for you. There is knowledge, there are skills, there are values, there are things that are great treasures. and they are yours. In order to receive blessings, though, there must be a way to receive them. So, if we're going to receive, in the case of the state, I suppose, it was probably in the form of cash. You know, what account? Well, if we don't have any account, it can't be sent there. If there's some other thing that we're to receive, we have to have some way to receive it. And so, it does happen sometimes that a person is entitled to something, but he's not interested. He's not interested. And the truth of it is that in order to receive God's blessings, it does require some work. Our greatest blessings calls us, I'll put it the other way, most of our problems that we have in life are involved with handling our blessings. When you think of the things that give you the most grief in your everyday life, when I say grief, I mean the everyday stone-in-the-shoe types of things. There are things involved with our blessings, things like keeping up our houses and our vehicles and our possessions, taking care of these things, upkeep, and because things are constantly wearing down. But we need these things. And yes, it does take work to receive and to work with blessings. And so there is work as we receive things from before. Now, the things that we talk about in the Christian school and with children are not so much material kinds of things and property kinds of things. These kinds of things are very easy to understand, and it isn't usually children aren't very old before they start to value having, quote, things. But the things that are really important and that we can start receiving at a very young age are, of course, other kinds of things in our heritage. Appreciation of family and grandparents and the world around us and nature and so on. Along with the idea of there being a great heritage for us to receive are the concepts in Hebrews 11 where it speaks of that vast train of people who have lived over the generations before us who did their works in faith. There's a whole catalog there, one of which is Abel, and it says that he being dead yet speaks. He is speaking today. And the acts of the people who have lived before us still speak today. But just because someone is speaking doesn't mean anybody is listening. We live in an age in which we train ourselves to tune things out. And it's easy to tune out things that we should listen to. So these people who have lived before, their acts and the mighty acts of these scriptural people, and also the works of many people in history that are worthwhile for us to know, that give us a foundation, a view of where we have come from, where society has come from, and some feel of where we're going and what we ought to do. These things give purpose in life. The fear of the Lord is the beginning. And in order to have purpose, I'm intrigued with the thought today that we live in a great age of boredom. Seems to be the pastime of people is to be bored. And it's a word that I don't recall being used like it is today, even a decade ago. People weren't as bored as they are now. And I think somebody ought to write a book about that. There's something characteristic of our age that involves, that causes this boredom. And a big part of it is, I think, simply a loss of a purpose, of value. There's really nothing worthwhile to live for. We've tried it all, and we're like the writer of Ecclesiastes. We've tried it all, and everything is hollow, chasing after the dust in the sunbeam. Futility, emptiness. Well, the truth of it is, though, that someone has spoken, and in addition to these people we read about in Hebrews having spoken, Christ, the true light, has shined and is shining today, but we don't see it unless we're helped to see. And so teachers need to point out to the children, see that? See what you're looking at? This is what you ought to see. It's possible to look at something and not see it. And also, the Word has spoken, the Word has been spoken in these last days by through Christ and by Christ, but many people do not hear. Some say it thunders. And even in Christ's day, when the Lord spoke, why not everyone heard? And so really, as we work with in the Christian schools, the children, in a sense, we could say, come to us from birth, born blind from birth and deaf from birth in some respects. The Lord does speak to hearts, but what I mean by that is that the teachers then, as they work with children, if we use this model, this view of having been entrusted to us a great heritage, which encompasses all the things that we do in school, all the skills, the knowledge, and even more importantly, the heart to seek out that knowledge and the heart to develop those skills. Those things we have in hand, and those are the things that we want to pass on to the next generation. Furthermore, what really gives purpose to our life and to our efforts in school is that not only do we receive this heritage, but we also work with it and we are to add to it. There's that fascinating thought at the end of Hebrews 11 that talks about this catalog of people, and it says that all these died in faith, not having received the promise. But then it refers to us. We have a place in this catalog. We are included in Hebrews 11. It says, God, having provided some better thing for us, that they, without us, should not be made perfect or complete. God has had a work that He wanted to do throughout the history of the world, from the creation of Adam to the call of Abraham, to the through the time of the patriarchs and the kings, and then Christ, and when Christ left, sending back His Holy Spirit and continuing His work through the apostles, and in this day, with us and through us. And so, to see that great train of people, that cloud of witnesses who has gone before us, have stood faithful, and then to pick up the torch, if you will, and continue on, and to realize that there is something worthwhile for us to do and to serve and to learn in God's plan. If there's anything that can charge us and that can energize us in a proper way, it's that, seeing how we really are to fit on here. Hebrews 11 really isn't finished after verse 40. It's to continue on, and people today are to pick up and to build. Now, in what are we trying to accomplish anyway in our Christian schools? Well, as we pass on this heritage, the difficult thing is to even see, to perceive that there is something. And children are put together in such a way that they do treasure those who, their parents and their teachers, when they're young. They trust them. They have an inherent trust they seem to be born with. They may not be able to articulate this, But they do value, and they do learn. And there are two passages in Proverbs in which wisdom is personified. Probably you could replace the word wisdom here with Christ and receive the same meaning and perhaps a bit more insight. But it talks in Proverbs 1:20 about wisdom crying without, uttering her voice in the streets, crying in the chief place of concourse, in the openings of the gates. In the city she uttereth her words, saying, "How long, ye simple ones, will ye love simplicity? And the scorners delight in their scorning, and fools hate knowledge." And it goes on saying, "Turn you and listen, and I will be very valuable to you." In Proverbs 8, the same thought. "Doth not wisdom cry, and understanding put forth her voice?" And it goes down through the catalog of things that wisdom will do for us. "I, wisdom, dwell with prudence, and I lead in the way of righteousness." And pointing out that wisdom is of in value far above rubies, far above anything, whatever. Rubies was probably chosen simply as something that would be the most valuable thing that those people would perceive. So think of the thing that you think is the most valuable, and then you take wisdom and place it above that. And so somehow, in the work of our Christian schools, we need to hold up wisdom and the invisible things of life as the things that really count. We need to somehow show and teach that there's something here to be had. There's something of value that's inherent, that's tied up with people and with those who have gone before, and with God and His work through people. And it's not primarily in material things. Well, on the school level, why, especially the elementary level and the high school level too, we're really working with the foundation with children. But the foundation is very important. Without the foundation, the building that's built, depending what foundation you lay, it dictates the kind of building that you will build or can build. And so even though the things that we do in a sense are very elementary in school, they are very important. Just because something is simple and elementary does not mean it's not vital. A foundation is a rather simple thing. You dig a deep enough ditch and wide enough and you have a ditch. It's rather simple, isn't it? And then you put some reinforcement, some concrete in there and just dump it in. It doesn't need to really be finished off so long as you have it level. And the whole thing gets covered up. You never look at it again. But who would argue that it's not one of the most important parts of the building? And so, yes, what happens there is very, very important. It's also the time to use a different analogy in which we kindle the interest. We kindle the... We work with the natural curiosity of a child. And those who study children tell us that there are certain sequences that they do go through. And it's interesting to see that as the children grow up. Our little girl's at the point now that she asks, "What's this?" And that, they say, is a predictable time. That comes first. First we ask the what. We want names for everything. And then after that will come the whys. That hasn't arrived yet with her. But as they grow, they have these interests, and we work with that. And the interests and the curiosities are awakened and developed, and we can set the course for life at this age as they learn the skills that they need. Why, even more importantly than learning those skills is to learn the attitudes and the habits that go along with these skills. How shall they be used? And what I'm saying then is that there is a tremendous heritage to pass on, an encompassing word for the knowledge of the various subjects, for the skills. And some of these things we sit down and learn in a period. We learn the Pythagorean theorem or some other principles, some laws relating to gravity and so on. And we learn these in a few minutes or a few hours, and we move on. But we need to realize that when we learn these things, we're in a sense standing on the shoulders of those who have gone before. Someone had to sit down one time and think hard, to realize that there is a relationship here with the triangle. And there is something that happens here with gravity and work out the various principles of writing and grammar and so on. Somebody had to do this. And so we ought to value those things that have been done by those who have gone before us and receive those things and work with them and use them. And what we don't use, of course, we lose. Now, what ties this overall charge of the Christian school in with the work here at Faith Builders is that schools really do need people. That's something that I don't understand, just what's involved there, but it's pretty apparent that God does need people to do His work. It would seem, in one way of looking at it, that God could do what He wants, and when it comes to doing His work, though, He looks for people to do it. There are various scriptures referring to that. In the case, for example, of Nineveh, when He wanted the message to go there, that in 40 days Nineveh shall fall, it would seem, in my human way of logic, that God could have spoken from the sky with a loud rumbling voice one day and say, in 40 days Nineveh shall fall. And I don't know what the response would have been there. I don't know if anybody would have listened, or if anybody would have heard, or if anybody would have cared or not. I bet I don't know. But He looked around and He wanted to find a person in flesh and blood who would actually walk to Nineveh and tell them His message. And you know the story with Jonah. He wasn't so willing, to put it mildly. But when he went, when a person went and gave the message, there was a result. And so that was one type of person. But God needs people like Jeremiah, who have a burden and have a heart that cares and cares deeply and is willing to live his life and pour out his soul and would have used as many eyes as he had to weep if he had had the opportunity. And he had a burden and a heart for God. When God has people like that who have a heart for Him and who care, people who see and have received themselves the blessing that comes from God directly through the brotherhood, through family, through those who have gone before, through their studies. There are many ways that we receive God's blessings, and there are many ways in which He speaks to us. When God finds people like that, then He's able to use them to work with children and to move children. Truth is a fascinating thing. It doesn't, in a sense, you could say that truth really almost doesn't appear to exist unless someone perceives it. There's the old question of if the tree falls in the woods and there's nobody to hear it, does it make a sound or doesn't it? Well, we could debate that a while. We pretty well agree that the air vibrates. Does it give a message to anybody? That's a little different question. Does anybody get the message if the tree falls and nobody hears it? Well, God needs and uses people, and truth must be incarnated, must be lived, must be valued by people. There are some people who will dig, who are interested in learning, that they will pretty much dig on their own no matter what material they have. But for the most part, why God needs warm-blooded, caring people to work with the next generation to to pass on those valuable things. And so, in summary, the work of the Christian school is to, in the few short years that we work with these children, to kindle and awaken the interest, to direct their curiosity in such a way that they will value the things of God through nature, through the various schools of thought, if you will. They will glory, and young people do glory in things, and it's a proper force to glory in the Lord. We also appreciate and find fulfillment in using the various talents and strengths and abilities and intelligences and interests that we have. And we need to understand that all these things are gifts of God. And in order for us to operate our schools and to fulfill this responsibility, we need people who have a heart for God and who have developed their own talents and their own abilities. And here is where there is help needed, because as we grow up and are prepared to teach, we do need the help of others to see how to go about doing this and to do it in an effective way. There's hardly a more important task than passing on the heritage that we have. And if there's anything in our work that should receive the full attention and support of the resources that we have in time and talent and energy, it's passing on what we have. And it's interesting, the efforts that people will go to, in many cases misdirected efforts, that parents will go to see that their children have, as some would say, a better life than I did, that they don't have to go through what I went through, and they'll go to great pains, often in misdirected ways, to see that their children have these things. But it is true that if our efforts are directed in the right way, and it's for the glory of God, then we ought to go to great pains to pass on these things to our children. All right, I'd like to then consider some things we can do to help. We've seen that the need is critical. The work is critical, one of the most critical that we have in the work of the church. And what can we do to help? There are answers. There are things we can do. Our question is to just know which tree we should be digging the roots of as we work here at Faith Builders. We don't want to be digging the roots and dunging the wrong tree. Or to know which discharge tube to park the truck under, if you will, to use the analogy, if you go to pick up a load of grain at the mill, and it's a gravity feed, there's a certain place, if you park your truck at the right place and they open the chute, your truck will be filled. Now, if you're cantankerous enough to decide that you'd rather park your truck on the other side of the parking lot instead, the wheat will in fact come out the tube, but you won't get any in your truck because you haven't parked at the right place. And you know, there are some people who are just cantankerous enough to say, well, the person who designed that mill there put that chute there, and I think it should have been put over here. So I'm going to park my truck here. I don't care where he put the chute. And they missed the blessing for that reason. And so as we think of the kinds of things that we ought to do, our question then is, which things, where is the blessing and where is the most effective thing to do? All right. First of all, I would say, use the analogy that's often used with in marriages. They say, if you want to have the best thing a husband can do for his family, for his children, is to love his wife and to be a good husband. And that goes a long way in dealing with the children. And so I would say the first thing that at Faith Builders here we ought to do is to be. That's an old question. Which is more important, to be or to do? And someone has said, don't just do something, sit there. And there are so many people running around, like I guess it was Ahimeaz, one of those chaps in the Old Testament who was so anxious to take a message. And he just couldn't wait until the battle was settled. He had to go. And they said, well, if you really have to go that day, well, okay, then you go. And so then he went. And when he arrived, all he could say was, I saw a great tumult. And there are many people like that today who just must be doing something. They can't wait before God. They aren't satisfied to be. So I'd say our first thing is be. What do I mean by that? Well, our first work as individuals and as churches, as schools, our first work is to honor God. Honor God. We're serving God. We're waiting on God in the sense that a waiter or waitress waits on a person in a restaurant. What can I do for you? Wait on the Lord. There are several ways you can look at that verse, and one of the helpful ways to understand that is to consider the concept of waiting as a waiter waits on someone who has come to be served. So serve, wait on God, honor God, focus on serving God. If it's God's work, and we agree that it is, then He's the one who gives direction. The person who has the responsibility for a task is in a position to come before God and ask how he should do. Take, for example, parents. When parents have their own children, they are the ones who have the responsibility to rear those children. And that father is in a position to go before God and ask God, how shall I do with this child? Just like Samson's parents asked the angel. In that case, God sent an angel to tell them specifically, these are the things that you should do with this child. And many have been the parents and people with other responsibilities who wished that perhaps God would send an angel to say, here's how you shall do. Well, the truth of it is that we have today the Holy Spirit to instruct us daily. And so, love God, serve God first and always. Let's be sure our focus is on serving God because it's God's work. And one of the biggest problems that God has is for people to take the bit in their own mouth, if you will, and be so charged with the responsibilities that they have that they have to pick up and try to carry the work on their own instead of having the Lord carry it. When the Lord gives us the responsibility to execute His will as an executor, if you will, included with that charge is the wherewithal, the strength, the wisdom, and the energy to carry it out. In our everyday executing of wills, it's commonly understood that within the proceeds of that will, there is provision made for the work of the executor for his time. And I submit that when God has us carry out His will, He also, within that, gives us the strength and the wisdom to carry out that work. And our meat actually becomes doing God's will. It's a self-energizing work. And so when we do God's, if we're really in God's will, we find that the work that we do is, in a sense, self-feeding. It's energizing in itself. When we start to appropriate God's work and to shift that weight from His shoulders to ours, if you will, why then it becomes enervating and tiring in a tearing down or discouraging sense. And so we are to have a burden, and there's a little poem about the camel that I've read that I liked, of how he kneels down at the close of each day to have his burden taken off. And then he has a night's rest. And then the next morning, he kneels down again and has the burden put on for the day. And then he goes and he carries it for the day. And when we find ourselves, burdens, by the way, are meant to be delivered. And it's very proper for us to be burdened. And if we are living in healthily in a day's work and don't have a burden, then we're not carrying, we're not delivering God's work. But burdens are meant to be delivered and not to be lived with. A burden is something that really is, in a sense, for us to carry, but it's not ours. And so that it's a very apt expression used with the prophets, that they had a burden from the Lord that they were delivering from Him to the people. And then once it was delivered, it was off their shoulders, they didn't have it anymore. And so in this first area, as I think of faith builders, we need to honor God, serve Him, love Him, and be prepared to discharge His responsibilities, to seek His face. And there was an interesting little book written some years back about submission. The title slips my mind right now, but the author made the point that when we really find our way in serving God, we really don't, when we realize that the responsibility of solving the problems of the world or the church or the family or whatever you will, that isn't our responsibility. It's the work of God. God builds His church and does the work involved there, and our responsibility is to serve. Now, it's important for us to have a heart for God. And if we have a servant who truly serves, that servant will have the same heart for the work that his master has. And he will care, and care deeply. And he may be working with weeping when he works. But he realizes that the master, it's the master's work, and he will not take to himself that which rightfully belongs to the master. We sometimes think of Lucifer's sin in being equal with God. And he was, of course, cast out from heaven for that. Well, we wouldn't be so arrogant to say that we're equal with God, but let's be careful that we don't try to assume that the work of God is our work. It's possible for us to shift, in a sense, to try to carry. It's like the woman who rode in the wagon, was picked up walking along the road, and she rode in the wagon, but she kept her shopping bag on her lap. And the driver said, "Well, why didn't you put the bag down on the floor?" And she said, "Well, it's kind enough of you to pick up me and take me without holding the bag too yet." Well, so often we don't take full appropriate the full grace of God by insisting on, "Well, I just have to carry this. It's mine." And God says, "It's not yours. Everything is mine, and I'll give you the grace to do the work." So, in our first area, we need to be. Secondly, I would say, as faith builders, one of the most important things we need to do is to pray. I'm not sure that anything good happens in this world but as an answer to prayer. I don't know the answer to that. But the older I get, the more my eyes are beginning to be opened to the fact that when we see good things that have happened, whether they are in the lives of the people around us, in our own lives, in the church, wherever, somebody prayed for that. And God uses people in many ways. And I don't know, I wouldn't suggest a percentage here or anything, but all I'll say is that prayer is absolutely necessary. It's vital for us to have a prayer burden and to call down God's blessing, to call down fire, if you will. I've served with a local fire department there for 27 years. And it's interesting how people will drive miles to see a fire. There was one time that there was a ruptured gas line, underground gas line blew out about 12 miles to the west of us. 3 o'clock in the morning. And we were staying by for a while. And I came out the door of the house facing west, and I saw the sun coming up. And it didn't strike me quite right away. And I thought, no, wait a minute, I am looking west, not east. The sun doesn't come up in the west. Well, the atmosphere was just right that particular morning that this gas line that was burning was able to light the atmosphere in such a way that it literally lit the horizon. And we live on a hill. It was phenomenal. And someone I had heard later saw that glow from Reading, Pennsylvania. And some young people, so they decided to see what this fire was. They knew it had to be something big. And so they started driving. And it was probably about 35 miles they drove. But once they drove far enough, they got more determined as they went each mile that if it was this big, well, it really had to be something. So they were going to stick this out and see where this was. And so they eventually got to as close as they could to the area. Of course, when there's a big enough fire, they have people to keep people back. But the people come. And that is always intrigues me, that really people do come to see fire. I heard a story of a church building burned one time, and people came, watched, and there were some people there who had been in the church already to service but hadn't been for years, and someone commented, "Oh, I hadn't seen you around here for a long time." They said, "No, I never saw a place on fire before." Well, if we can call down God's blessing, that He really continues and enlarges the work here. It was alluded to yesterday about dark ages, and it's always a struggle to keep light going. You know, light, we need a constant source of light in order to have light. As soon as the light goes out, it's dark that quickly. And we think of the dark ages, we read about the dark ages, but we're only one generation away, if that far, from a dark age, if indeed we aren't in one now. And so we need to care about the darkness and the loss of vision. There are several verses I'd like to allude to here as we consider praying for the work. As we think of helping Christian schools, one of the most vital, if not the most vital things that we can actually do would be to pray. I just heard a story of a couple weeks ago about one of the American evangelists, I think it was at Moody, went to Scotland, I believe it was, and he was asked to preach at a service on Sunday morning. He wasn't really expecting to be asked and wasn't prepared for some reason. Anyway, so he did, but it was quite a labor. He particularly wasn't prepared, didn't feel the freedom of the Spirit. But that evening, it was a different story. And that time, he felt very free, and there was a phenomenal response from the congregation. I believe hundreds of people came forward, and furthermore, these people followed through over the next months. It really seemed to be a serious commitment. And years later, it was found out that there was a handicapped, an older lady who was bedfast, who learned that day at noontime that this evangelist was there and had spoken in the morning and was going to speak again in the evening. And she said, "Oh, if only I had known he was going to be here this morning, I could have prayed more directly." She said, "I've been praying for I don't know how long, it might have been years, that this man would come someday to their community." But she didn't know he was there that morning. At noontime, when she found out he was there, she said, "Shut the door. I don't want any lunch. She said, I need to pray." And she spent the afternoon praying. And I wonder sometimes, the evangelist, his mouth spoke that evening. Do you know the mouth that speaks is the mouth that speaks. But the other parts of the body are just as important. And who's to say? In that case, it seemed pretty obvious that what made the difference was one person praying. In Luke 19, it was alluded to yesterday how that Jesus, in verse 41 and 42, came and he looked over Jerusalem and he wept. And he saw what could be theirs, and they didn't see it. Furthermore, he didn't only see what was theirs; he had it, and he was ready to give it. But they didn't see it, and they didn't really care. And furthermore, they were ready to crucify him. And someone has said that in our day, the story goes, somebody asked a friend of his, "Do you know what the two biggest problems are with our society today?" And the other person said, "I don't know, and I don't care." He said, "You're right. Those are the two problems in our society today." And even today, we need to know, as we consider the work of schools and as we consider training teachers, we need to know what things belong to their peace. We need to know what things ought to happen in a school, how children should be taught. And we need to have that compassion that Jesus had, that he wept over Jerusalem. If only you had known. And then there are several fascinating verses in the Old Testament I'd just like to read. One of them in Joel 2:17. Joel writes, "Let the priests, the ministers of the Lord, weep between the porch and the altar, and let them say, Spare thy people, O Lord, and give not thine heritage to reproach, that the heathen should rule over them. Wherefore should they say among the people, Where is their God?" We're in a time when we are seeing the second generation of Christian schools. And usually when a school begins, when a community begins a school, there's great interest in it by those who start it, because they put their own sweat and tears and work into the effort. But as the next generation or two comes online and receives this building and this program that the generation or two before them started, their task is to maintain the vision and to add on to that vision and to maintain the light so that God's heritage doesn't become a reproach. And we see sometimes that the interest or the vision for the need of even minimal training is not valued, is not even perceived by those who are operating schools. And this is something that you can't really just change. It's something that God has to change. It's an area that I believe is a ripe area for prayer, that the Lord would move the hearts of those who are responsible for their schools, that they would see a need for proper training. And then there's the reference in Ezekiel 22:30, where he talks about looking around for a man to stand in the gap. And that is another area, talking about praying specifically. The other week, Brother Tim Kennedy shared in the prayer session here, prayer meeting, about some promises that we can stand on to pray. And so I think it's important as we pray that we find specific promises to stand on and pray for them. And I think this would be one of those, for example, where he says God apparently was looking for a man among them that should make up the hedge and stand in the gap before me for the land, or the people, if you will, that I should not destroy it, but I found none. Now that's referring to going into captivity, but we are always on the verge of darkness if we don't hold up the light. We don't let our light shine on the hill. If our light is in a bushel or is not held up, we're always on the verge of darkness. And God is always seeking for a man. In Chronicles, it talks about his eyes going to and fro over the earth, just looking for people. And so we need to pray for people. The reference is also in Matthew 9, where Jesus told the disciples that the fields are ripe unto harvest. Pray, therefore, that the Lord of harvest, that he would send forth laborers. Now, that seems a bit strange. If, in fact, the harvest was ready, and if laborers could be sent forth, it would seem that there are laborers somewhere who had the strength to take the harvest. Why should we need to pray that they would be sent? Well, Jesus himself told the disciples, you are to pray that there would be laborers sent. We can assume from that if they did not pray, there would not be as many, if any, laborers. And so, it almost seems that nothing but by prayer. Now, as I mentioned, in the case of a father, he's the one who is in a position to go before God and ask for wisdom on how to deal with his child, because he's the one that has the child, and God will honor that prayer, because he's the one that's charged with the responsibility. So, in our case here at Faith Builders, where we actually work with teachers, with training teachers, we are the ones who really are in a position to go before God and ask for the wisdom in developing program, in having laborers sent. It certainly is true that in the schools across our land, the fields are ripe. There, the children are there, and we cannot wait, because they are already growing. And already as I speak, they're getting older, and the need is there. Now, when we get up from prayer, there are things to do sometimes too. Let me hasten to say that prayer is not the only thing to do. In the case when Moses came down off the mountain, why, he had to do something. He had to get rid of the golden image. He couldn't just stay with God and say, well, God, take care of them. He actually was in God's very presence, and God had to dismiss his session with Moses for a while. Moses had to go down there and destroy this image and grind it up and so on. And so there is a time to get off of our knees and make phone calls and make visits and do things. But if we pray, I believe we will know when the time is for us to do that. So prayer. Call down the fire that of God's spirit, of his energy, of his direction. Pray for people to stand in the gap. Pray for laborers in the harvest, and make prayer a daily part. And as trainees come here, they should sense that this is a house of prayer. This is a place where prayer is pervasive, where things happen as a result of prayer. I don't have much to say about a third area here, just briefly. As we work here at Faith Builder, there ought to be a model school operating. And it was encouragement to me to hear when the school began, the parochial school, it opened with, I believe, 30-some students on its first day. And the student body was here. That was something that was quite encouraging, because it would be difficult to have a trainee program where there's not a school to work in. And so that is an area that happened rather easily, it seemed, as far as it wasn't difficult to go out and recruit students. Now, I would say that as we work here, it's important that the school be a model school. No school is perfect, but also we need to keep in mind that even though the reason for coming here and beginning this school was to train teachers, to have teachers have an opportunity to be trained, we cannot have the work of that school take a back seat. The school needs to be a valid school in its own right. It needs to serve the community and serve the people. And the people in this school should not have a sense that they are being used, that what we really want to do is train teachers, and that we kind of, in order to do that, we have to have a school, and so we have the school. Now, I'm not at all suggesting it is that way. I've never visited here or seen the school in operation. I'm only saying this from an objective point of view, that vision of truly serving the community and the student body as a school needs to be balanced properly, so that they feel that we really have a heart for the school here. And then, of course, teachers having an opportunity to apprentice in that school is, I believe, the ideal approach for an apprentice-type approach. A fourth area under how faith builders can help, after the first being to serve God, to honor God, and then to pray, and then to operate a school. Fourth one being, I believe there are perhaps some ways in which faith builders can help schools out there across the states directly, some of which they have already. One of these would be to have resource people available to visit and speak, and in some small way be available to schools. It's often the case at schools when they have a parent-teachers meeting that the parent-teachers group, may wonder, well, now what can we do at this meeting? Shall we have a speaker? And if so, who and what shall the topic be? And sometimes they scratch their heads wondering, what can we do to other than the humdrum that we've done the last 7 years? Does anybody have any new ideas? Well, there could be some parent-teacher groups that would be just happy to have someone available to come in from a place like Faith Builders to share with their parent-teacher group at a parent-teacher meeting. And so in the local school area, whether it's speaking at a parent-teacher meeting or whether it's going and speaking to a school board, or perhaps teachers in service gathering, either in a school or in a regional or local area, That could be done by request from the local school, might ask for someone to come, or possibly some ready-made topics, if you will, or sessions could be available with a bit of a description, and this could be sent to schools because it's difficult to ask for something if you don't know something is available or something exists. So if there were some topics developed and schools were made aware that this and this topic has been developed, if it seems of interest to you and you would like someone to come and address you on this topic or in this area, whether it's curriculum, teacher relations, or philosophy of education or whatever, if you're in, if these things are of interest to you, here's who you can contact, here's how it would work, and the person could come. And either staff people here, Faith Builders, or off campus other people that are associated with Faith Builders from Kansas to Pennsylvania, who are more living in the area, could go and share in that way and still be able to represent Faith Builders if they're involved here, perhaps in the summer or in some other ways. There would be a possibility also that some schools, rather than having someone come to speak at a meeting, might be interested in having a contact person to consult with in some area, whether it's curriculum development or questions regarding the program or whatever. So if there's some way that there could be, the schools could be made aware that there are people available, if you're interested, to come and speak, to sit down and talk with you or whatever, to genuinely help the school. And that in turn may develop interest in training here, but I think especially of reaching at the grassroots level where people could speak to parent groups, because there's really where it's at. Parents need to have the vision of how important the work is for their children and need to maintain and add to vision generation after generation. And the fifth area goes without saying, the work of training teachers here. Paul wrote to Timothy that you should commit these things that you've heard of me, you should commit to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. And that by far, of course, is the important work here, to teach teachers who will be able to then go and teach. And I think it's important to keep a good balance in the classes and in the sessions here between teaching and understanding principles and also receiving practical ideas. Just a few comments on that. The problem with teaching only principles is that there are some people who really don't see a connection between the principle and the situation when they arrive out there. And so you might realize that the car has a jack in the trunk. This is a bit of extreme exaggeration, but if you get out there along the road and have a flat tire and wonder what to do, someone tells you, well, you learned there's a jack in the trunk. Oh, yes, I guess I could have used to jack the car up, couldn't I? Well, if we understand the principle and see how it applies, some people need to be shown that principles do apply, that these things that you learn, actually you do use them as you teach. It's often been said by people who went through a four-year teacher training program and took numerous methods courses that, well, yes, you go through the program, but then when you actually get out there in the school, you pretty well teach the way you were taught. You do what works, regardless of what the book says. That's sometimes said tongue-in-cheek, sometimes seriously. And so that there could be a problem there. Perhaps the methods that they were given really weren't good, but perhaps also they weren't shown a way to put to practice. And so people often say, well, give me the practical stuff. I want to go and learn something I can take home and use. Well, that sounds very good, and it is good in balance. The problem is that if we are intensely practical only, why then we really only learn what we need for the given situation. And so if you learn how to apply a certain method to one particular book or curriculum, and something changes in another school or another class, and you don't use that book or whatever, well then you don't know what to do, because you haven't been taught what to do in this next situation. And so the person who only studies the practical approaches sometimes is at quite at a loss when he is put in a different situation, because he has no principles, no overriding principles to direct him. So some areas to emphasize in the teacher training here. Number one would be academic, or what you might call content knowledge. It's important for teachers to know some material. There's the old saying about he who knows that he knows. The wise one is the one who knows and knows that he knows. He's not proud, but he knows that he knows. If we want to go up to Presque Isle, we want somebody in the car that knows how to get there and knows that he knows how to get there. That's the person you feel confident to travel with. So we need to know some material. It's important for a young teacher to have the experience of mastering something. When we master something, it provides a valid confidence that's based on something that we actually have done and can do. That gives us confidence then to go on and do that, and also to do other things. None of us, nobody ever masters everything. We can't do that anyway. But we better have, if we're going to teach, we better have mastered something. And there needs to be some area or areas that we feel some competence in to teach. And furthermore, we need to value truth. We need to value knowledge in a proper way. And so some areas under these contents that I believe it's important for us to know are to know and appreciate the history, the story, if you will, of man and the church. Because knowing the scope of where we have come from, I say sometimes people who talk about how bad things are today, things are bad, I won't argue that, but many people who talk about it really don't know their history. Because I'm not sure that we want to go back and live under the Assyrians or have them capture us, or live in quite a few other times when, most of us are satisfied to stay living here where we are. But things must have been pretty bad to pack up and, in fact, maybe not even pack up, to just get out of your homeland and to travel without means of transportation or even finance. And so, yes, it's important for us to know some history to appreciate the kinds of things that happened before and to value more the work of God through time and through the day, through this time. And as we study that history, what's even more important than knowing what has happened is to have that proper perspective that history started someplace. There is a time when history started. And there is a destination, and there is an end also, and we aren't just here in an endless wandering, an endless cycle, but there is a direction, and God is in control, and He's standing behind, keeping watch over His own. It's important to have that certainty, and to realize that God is there, and even though awful things happened. The question was raised by one of the characters in Macbeth when his family was killed. He said, in my words now, he said, "And did heaven stand by and just watch this happen? All my wife and my innocent babes, all dead?" Yes, some awful things have happened in history, And God did stand by, but he also stood by when Christ was crucified. And it does pain him at the heart. And so, yes, as we study history and see the things that happen, God is there and he is in control. And there's that certainty and that basic perspective and view is so important to have. It's almost more important than the facts and the information. And so that's the kind of thing that we need to be sure that our trainees pick up as they study history, that there's a beginning, there's an end, there's a movement, God's in charge, there is something here that's worthwhile to learn, and there's something worthwhile to pass on. And in the sciences, it's important to appreciate a science and know the purpose of science and the limits of science. And God has given men the knowledge and the ability to seek out witty inventions. And when God's Spirit comes upon a man and starts using him, why, it's only then that you see the real person that person was intended to be. And in the Old Testament, when they were to build the tabernacle, why, God said there are people out there, when they were given all these things they had to do, they had to build the tabernacle and make the weavings and the tapestries and the metalwork and so on, God said, there are people out there whom I have put my Spirit upon, and they already know how to do this. And nothing will please them so much as for you to go and ask them to do that work for me. That's in my words now. And so this the people who have the mind for science, for technology, these things can be used to serve God. And it's a God-given talent and ability. And if there's anything that should humble us, why, it's studying God's creation and his works and his hidden things in mathematics and logic. And as we see some of the puzzles and patterns in mathematics, you can almost imagine God standing back and smiling when we discover some of these things and saying, oh, I see you found that one. Now, I wonder if you're going to find this one. Maybe you'll find that one someday too. And we really are seeing the mind of God. And so as we teach our teachers, let's have them understand that in every field we look, we can't look in any field of knowledge without seeing the hand of God. And without hearing God speaking, he reveals himself through living things. He reveals himself through patterns, through the mind. And then a third area, studying some good literature. As it was referred to yesterday, I believe that literature is the language of the heart. Science, math, if you will, is the language of the mind. Literature is more the language of the heart. And where we understand how people feel and the great things that move people. And then it's important to have an appreciation and some familiarity with music and art. Also, to love and to study the Word. And then in various other areas, some math, logic, thinking, writing, reading, and the ability to speak well. Those would be content areas. The second area to work on in training teachers is skills. And that's in helping teachers in how to teach others to do. We understand and we do. Those are two big areas of training. Understanding and appreciating things for their own good, and then also how to do. And so, of course, these are the principles and methods courses or apprenticeship type learning. And the key, of course, is to train people, to teach people in such a way that they can inspire others to learn. And that's a tall order, but it's an important one. It's one thing to teach somebody something, it's something else to inspire someone, to inspire a student to aspire and to apply himself. A third area to emphasize is to have teachers understand children, how children think, how children feel, and how they learn. I should have said how they feel first, because children primarily are come to you feeling before they think. And especially elementary children, they're great feelers. And if they feel all right about each other and about you and about the program and their classmates, then they're in a position to think and to get on with some learning. So we need to understand how children feel, how they think, and how they learn. Teachers need to know how to love and how to show love and affection to children. That's one of the most critical things. We talk a lot about teaching facts and knowledge and skills, but really, children are affectionate and they need affection. And they need to know that the teachers care and care deeply. And they need to know that the teachers care about them as people, regardless of what they can do. So often, children today get the feeling that I'm valued because of what I can do. That's true of both the fast and the slow, the gifted and the average. The feeling that, well, if I didn't do so well, if I wouldn't be so exceptional in one way or another, would anybody notice me? Would anybody care? Do you care about me because I can sing so well? Do you care about me because I'm an excellent math student, because I get all A's in your tests? Is that why you care about me? Or do you care about me because you love me? And many times when children act out, this is a reason for it. They want to find out, is you're caring about me, is it based on true? They don't consciously ask this. Is it based on true affection, true caring, or is it based on my following the normal routines and living up to your expectations? So we need to know how to show love and affection. And as trainees come here, why, of course, you come from various backgrounds, and we need ourselves as teachers, we need to experience love and affection and caring by others in order to be able to share that with others. So that needs to be a genuine part of the program for teachers themselves to experience caring from those they are around in order to be able to share that with others. A fourth area is to work with teachers so that they can develop a vision with purpose that leads to fruit bearing. They need to develop a vision with purpose that leads to fruit bearing. Now, we pretty well agree that we have a very important purpose. We need to train up children. But sometimes we don't quite have the vision of how to go about this. So we try various ways. Or then, of course, we sometimes have visionaries. I think this will work or that will work, or I might try this or I might try that. But the purpose might be a personal agenda or just because it intrigues me. And somehow we need to have a valid purpose of serving God and working with His children. And then we need to have the vision, the understanding of how to do that. And those two things, the understanding and the purpose and the heart together, can give us the ability to bear fruit in teaching. I think as a goal, any institution like this that works with young people that are planning to go back home to their communities and serve ought to have written very brightly in its goals that these young people should return back home better adjusted and better equipped to contribute and to fit in to their home communities than they were when they came here. Let it not be said that the young people come here and then go back home with an agenda of how I need to change this and need to change that. It so often happens that young people may go off somewhere to whatever kind of program and come back home, and now everyone else needs to understand how it is now, how I see it, and we need to change the status quo.
Now, there are always changes, and there are growths that are needed. But somehow, as if the young people come here and are cared for, cared about, and nurtured and trained in the proper way, when they go back home, they should be able to fit in and serve and to build up and edify. And I like the scripture that says that if you really think of the meaning of the words, it says that knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. And there's the big difference there between being blown up like a balloon or between having substance, having building there. And so let's work, if we have that as a goal, as a vision of faith builders, of developing people who care, people who have compassion, people who know what belongs to the peace of their home communities and are prepared to go back home and to pour themselves into the work, to give themselves, to spend and be spent for the home communities, why the home communities will deeply appreciate that if they can fit in. And then the fifth and the last area, along with learning the content, the skills, understanding children, and developing a vision of how to teach, teachers need to live. This is perhaps the most important one. This is the one that if we don't do as teachers, we soon wear out or burn out. We need to teach. The teacher needs to teach out of the abundance of his heart. The teacher needs to first live, serve God, serve his family, care about his or her family, whether they're head of a household or whether they're part of a family. They need to have a life. They need to live. A teacher needs to be a learner, to be a model. Children learn more from example. They learn maybe not quantity of facts, but as far as the influence in children's lives and the way their lives are changed, they probably are influenced more by who the teacher is and what the teacher does than by what the teacher says. And so if we expect children to follow us, become like us, we need to first be learners ourselves. We need to ourselves appreciate the heritage that we have received. We need to be working with that, adding on to it, building up, helping to build in God's kingdom, passing on the torch, stirring up our own gifts so that children see that we really are, we're real. We're real. And we really are living. We aren't just dispensing knowledge, or we aren't just living to teach, but we're living to live and serve God. And so some specific ways in which I believe that the life of the individual can be nurtured here are, I would say, A, to have a discipline in dorm life and in study life, to do what we can to see that the students have a prayer time, a valid social life, some group activities, some genuine opportunities for conversation, and work at developing character that students can follow. And I'm glad it was addressed yesterday, the whole aspect of discipleship, but oftentimes in teacher training programs, we think of the courses. What are the courses? But the vital question to ask is, what kind of people, what is it our burden to turn out? What type of people? What type of character? Jesus taught by word, by deed, and by being. He actually was God incarnate, God in flesh. And when Jesus came, he had more patience than Job. He had more faith than Abraham, more meekness than Moses, more courage than Joshua, more strength than Samson, more wisdom than Solomon, more heart than David, greater visions than Isaiah, more compassion than Jeremiah, more discipline than Daniel, more obedience than Jonah. And he was all these things. He was God incarnate, and He lives today, and He lives in us. And so we also, as teachers, need to incarnate truth. We need to live it out so children can see it in our lives. Expressing the truth is far more than verbalizing the truth. We express the truth, as someone had said, preach every day, and if necessary, use words. But we do it by our lives. They say that water will rise no higher than its source, so we need a high view in order for children to come up. Let's remember, though, that Christ lives in us, and so in fact He is higher than we are, and the children can, in a sense, rise higher than their teachers because of Christ working through their teachers. And in fact, the next generation should build on and should go beyond where we went. And so let's have as a goal that the next generation not only would maintain the vision, but would add to and would reach some heights that we were not able to reach. Teachers should be people who rejoice in the truth. They love the truth for the truth's sake. Truth is interesting. It must be interpreted through people. It lives in people. Life is more than bread. It's more than power. It's more than popularity. In Proverbs, it talks about it being the glory of God to conceal a thing, and it's the honor of kings to search it out. And there is value in searching out truth and having truth for the sake of having truth. There is a problem with practicality, with utilitarianism. It's very common for people to ask, what can I use this for? How will I ever use this? Sounds like a valid question. We sometimes have to put up our defenses and say, well, I guess maybe you could use it for this or use it for that. But wait a minute. That might be an all right question to ask when we talk about money or skills or knowledge or time. But for the things that really count in life, you better not ask that question. Imagine somebody asking that about people. What can I use this man for? What can I use my brother for? What can I use my wife for? How can I use her? What can I use Jesus for? What can I use God for? If somebody asks a question like that, you immediately say, you have a big problem. The problem is two things. You're saying, what can I? There's a problem with pride. And the word use, you don't use God. We bow, we serve, we worship. And the things that really count in life are not things that we use. They're things that we relate to, we value being around. They're not to be used. Jesus is not to be used. Our families are not to be used. Our children are not to be used. The things that we use are dispensable. They're good. They have their place. We need some food. We need some gardens. We can use them. But what really counts is things that we cannot use. Meaning is in people and in relationships. And so as we work with training teachers, let's develop that vision to live, to rejoice in the truth, to be an example, to be learners who see that there are important things in life. There are some things that we need to learn to use, but the things that really count are people. Leading is a serious calling, for the followers not only arrive where the leader goes, but they also become like the leader in the process. We could say that that's how they arrive. They arrive by becoming like the leader. For they will do what he would do and go where he would go by their own volition. Let us follow Christ the leader. Follow the followers of our leader. Lead our followers and lead the followers of our followers. Lead and follow, follow and lead toward Christ, to Christ, in Christ. Thank you.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.